Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Good to have you here. Coming up on the program today, battling the second wave and holding out for a vaccine.
We're seeing record spikes this morning across the country. So I urge the premiers and the mayors to please do the right thing.
So are they doing the right thing? As numbers surge in Manitoba and Toronto bringing new restrictions, Justin Trudeau is calling on provincial and municipal leaders to do the right thing. What does he actually mean? Is Canada ready to rush a vaccine to the public? We're going to cover a lot of that today. We've got the procurement minister, Anita Anand, standing by in moments, and then the mayor of Winnipeg. Then Alex Manassian in court. What is his defense? The man accused of killing 10 people and injuring badly 16 others in that deadly Toronto mass killing is pleading not criminally responsible on all charges. What does that actually mean? In moments, we're going to get the latest from CTV's Heather Wright on that case. Plus, Republicans rally around Donald Trump.
President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
Senior Republicans are backing Donald Trump's refusal to concede the U.S. election. What could it mean for a transition to a Joe Biden administration? And where does Canada fit into the dispute? We'll head south, bring you the latest from D.C. Also, a Liberal MP tossed from her caucus for hiring her sister and trying to hide it. Should she have to pay back the money? We dig into that on the press gallery. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Well, it's been another difficult day in the fight against COVID-19. Ontario hit another record today, 1,388 cases, 15 deaths. The city of Toronto announced further restrictions on top of those already mandated from the province. In Quebec, 9 people died, where 1,162 cases were reported today. Manitoba, and we'll speak to the mayor of Winnipeg in a minute, announced 384 cases and 5 deaths and moved their entire province onto code red. All that led to an urgent plea from the Prime Minister today, Justin Trudeau, calling on the provinces, as you saw in that clip earlier, to do the right thing and act now, as if they're not doing enough, to curb the dramatic rise. But what did he mean? And as that happens, there are new questions emerging about some positive news, and we need that, about Pfizer's vaccine candidate that's showing, apparently, 90% effectiveness. But when will you, when will Canadians get it, and what will a potential rollout look like? Let's find out. Joining me now is the procurement minister, Anita Anand. Minister, always a pleasure to have you on the program and hope your loved ones are doing well. Justin Trudeau, the prime minister, spoke directly to the provinces today. He told them to act now and not keep businesses open at the expense of the COVID fight. We know the curve is bending the wrong way right now. We're trying to interpret what he meant. Was he implying that some provinces are opening too quickly? What did he mean exactly?
Well, thanks for having me on, Evan. It's great to see you again. And yes, the Prime Minister was speaking directly to Canadians and the provinces, as he has done throughout this pandemic, in terms of meeting with them over 20 times and making sure that this collaborative relationship continues. But for my part, Evan, I'm focused on procurement for Canadians. We've procured over 37 million rapid tests, over 1 billion items of PPE, and up to 414 doses across 7 candidates of vaccines. And so that's the business that I'm focused on each and every day, right, Evan, and I would love to chat with you more about that.
Okay, and we're going to get to that in just one second. I'm just trying to figure out if the cabinet thinks something's missing in terms that is the assumption that, I don't know, something's missing in terms of support from the federal government, and the provinces could just speak up. Is there a sense that the provinces who have, you say, the federal government's given money, procured a lot, that the provinces aren't handling things the right way?
I think the messaging is simply that we need to keep the hatchets down. We need to make sure that we are social distancing. We need to make sure that we are wearing masks, and we need to make sure that we are keeping as safe as possible. And this goes right back to the science, right back to the public health advice that we have been adhering to from day one. And I believe the Prime Minister was continuing to make that message heard, as well as emphasizing the importance of the COVID COVID-19 app.
Some hopeful news from Pfizer yesterday that their candidate for a vaccine is showing 90% effectiveness. Of course, it's not done. You need two doses of it. Canada procured 20 million doses. Because it's a two-dose shot, 10 million Canadians could get access to that. Will Canada secure more of that particular potential vaccine for Canadians? Are you in pursuit of that?
Well, thank you for the question. And I will say right off the top, however, that we have 7 vaccine candidates across different vaccine types. So it's important to put the Pfizer announcement into context. We have already procured 194 million doses, and we have options up to 414 doses overall. In terms of the Pfizer agreement, you're right. We have 20 million doses procured, and we have options on 56 million doses. And we are continuing to follow the advice of the Vaccine Task Force and the Public Health Agency of Canada in terms of additional acquisitions with any of these vaccine corporations.
Okay, 56 million doses optional on that. So 36 million, I guess. When do you expect, I don't want to dampen the hope. We all hope this thing works. When would you expect all Canadians to have access to this vaccine or another vaccine if, in fact, it is successful?
So I want to, again, put this into context, Evan, because when you're talking about 7 different vaccines and up to 414 million doses of vaccines, you can imagine that the most important issue will be whether a vaccine is approved by Health Canada. That's the most important thing, and the timeline will vary for each company. And so there will not be one date on which all vaccines are available.
I get that, but is there a sense of the timeline? You know,
yes,
Canadians are hopeful here.
What's
the sense of a timeline?
Of course, and they are hopeful because we are hearing positive news about vaccines. And in terms of what that means from a contractual standpoint, Evan, we have negotiated very hard in terms of our delivery schedules with each of these vaccine companies. And like the EU, like Australia and Japan, we have deliveries in the first part of 2021 if all goes well with Health Canada approval and, of course, their own clinical trials. So there are a number of moving parts in this conversation, Evan, but from a procurement standpoint, we are doing our part in terms of negotiating those delivery dates.
Okay, so I just want to make sure, if I repeated then, you said the first part of 2021. So if I said, Anita Anand said that if the Pfizer, for example, if the Pfizer vaccine works, and they produce that 50 or 60 million first doses, Canada can expect to get that in the first part of 2021. That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. The Prime Minister has said it, and the Minister of Health as well, because that's what our agreements with these companies say. But all of us have the caveat, and we must have the caveat of Health Canada approval, Evan, and that is a moving target. Health Canada has begun a rolling review of 3 candidates, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca, and Canada is taking part in sharing vaccine data internationally with partner nations countries to expedite the review process, as well as investing $173 million in Medicago's development in Canada. So we have a made-in-Canada solution also.
I spoke to the health critics yesterday. Don Davies from the NDP said, look, one of the big questions is the ethics of distribution and how this will roll out. As he pointed out, the United States has a vaccine protocol that is effective November 15th. He and the Conservatives have both said, where's our plan? Do we have a vaccine rollout plan? And if so, when does it start and what does it do?
Very good question, Evan. And I will say that we have 4 parts of our plan. The first is the regulatory process, which I've already alluded to. The second is biomanufacturing, fill and finish. We've invested $126 million in the NML's Royal Mount facility. We've invested in fill and finish machines from Burnaby's VanRx. And we're making sure that we have the fill and finish capacity here in Canada Thirdly is the distribution phase. We have issued a letter of interest for expressions. We've heard from 70 companies in terms of their abilities to provide support, cold chain experts, couriers, healthcare supply chain experts, and those contracts will be in place in the next few weeks. And then we have finally the administration of the vaccine, and we are well supported in that regard with our procurements. We've procured 90 million syringes. We've procured 100 million needles from Becton Dickinson's, sharp containers, right. 90 million alcohol swabs, 75 right. million bandages. So those are the four phases that we are looking at. Evan, we're working across government with Minister Haidu, the Public Health Agency of Canada, and with provinces and territories as well.
Two quick things. One, will your government commit to making it available, any potential vaccine of the myriad you've got, free to all Canadians? And two, do you, because it's going to not roll out to everyone all at once, who gets it first? What's the plan?
I believe the Prime Minister said in the House of Commons in a response to a question posed by Jagmeet Singh that the vaccine would be available without charge to Canadians. And in addition, the Prime Minister has mentioned that vulnerable communities and first responders, public health care professionals, will also be within the parameters of the first people vaccinated. Okay. But again, that is a conversation that we are having across government. And the provinces and territories are extremely important in that conversation because they're in charge of dispensing health care.
Okay. So just on that last thing, the Ontario Premier Doug Ford wants the federal government to replace the 14-day quarantine period with rapid testing. Again, that's a procurement issue as well. Do we get enough? Is that possible? Is that going to happen?
Well, that's a great question, Evan. And as a procurement minister, my role is to make sure we have rapid tests in Canada. We've procured over 37 million rapid tests, and we have additional negotiations that are ongoing. And so I would leave that conversation to the provincial and territorial counterparts with the federal government to identify how those rapid tests are going to be deployed and whether it makes sense for any one jurisdiction to loosen border restrictions.
Right. Minister Anand, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Evan. Take care.
A crucial moment. A group of mayors from Canada's biggest cities are ready to support Canadians through the second wave of COVID-19, but they say they need the federal government's help. The Big City Mayors Caucus are meeting with cabinet ministers ahead of the fall economic outlook. What do the municipalities need to make it through the COVID-19 pandemic? We're joined now by the Winnipeg Mayor, Brian Bowman, whose city is reeling in the wake of an outbreak at a long-term care home. Eight people died last weekend at the Maples Long-Term Care Home. Mayor, first of all, it's always good to have you on the program. All of us are sorry about this horrible outbreak. How bad is the outbreak? Can you tell us how this happened?
It's been sickening to see what we're seeing in not just that personal care home, but just the rate of increase of COVID that we've seen in the last number of weeks has been alarming. Our test positivity rate today, the province announced, I believe, was 10.9 in terms of the test positivity rate. So we're not going in the right direction. The province has taken some measures today to bring in kind of that code red province-wide. And obviously a lot of folks are welcoming that because we don't have a handle on the virus right now, and we need to get back to flattening the curve like we did in the summer.
You've asked for military support. Tell me why you need that and what else you want from the federal government.
You know, what I was asking for was for the province just to get help. Because right now they really do need help. We've been providing assistance to the extent that we can, including having our ambulance operators at Maples Personal Care Home over the weekend to try to provide some assistance. But, you know, I think finding those extra resources, whether they're from within the provincial government or they're the Canadian Armed Forces, I'd get that level of support as quickly as you can. You know, we know how to weather storms here in Manitoba. I just look back at the flood of the century in 97, where it really was all hands on deck. And we need that same approach to dealing with the pandemic because we're not going in the right direction right now.
The Prime Minister seemed to suggest that the provinces have to sort of get their houses in order today. You heard that. What did you make of that?
You know, I think there's a role for all three levels of government. And right now, Canadians need us working together in ways that they haven't seen today, like just even stronger. And so We've had a really strong partnership with both levels of government. The federal government has stepped up in terms of financial supports. They're really bailing municipalities out right now so that we can continue to operate the services that people need right now during the storm. But, you know, there's a role for all three levels of government, and that each of us need to step up.
Your province is in full code red now. So you know, you got the long-term care home outbreak. What needs to happen to flatten the curve, in your view?
Well, I think everybody needs to step up. I mean, individual Winnipeggers, Canadians need to make sure they're sticking to those fundamentals of washing your hands, wearing a mask, and watching your distance. They need to stay home and come out for, you know, essential work and essential services. But there's a lot more work we all need to do. And, you know, what we've been urging all levels of government to do even better job, including our provincial government, is really to try to be more proactive, learn the lessons from other jurisdictions. Personal care homes is one example. Try to get ahead of that curve. And we're trying to offer that support to the best that we can as a municipality. We've got the majority of Manitobans here in the city of Winnipeg, after all.
It's a great town. We hope. Wish you guys the best. Thanks so much, Mayor.
Yeah, thanks, Evan.
All right, let's turn to Toronto. And a totally different situation, because we're watching day one of the trial for the man accused of driving a van down a busy sidewalk in Toronto, killing 10 people, injuring 16 others. My sister worked at an office literally overlooking that street. I remember that day well. 28-year-old Alec Manassian is pleading not criminally responsible to 26 charges, 10 counts of first-degree murder, 16 counts of attempted murder. He has previously admitted in court to planning and carrying out the 2018 attack. Let me bring in the CTV National News correspondent, Heather Wright, for more details on this. Heather, okay, it was like a Zoom trial, as it were, a virtual trial. What happened today, Heather?
Well, there was a lot of procedure today, Evan. There were some technical difficulties at the beginning of the trial, so it was sort of pushed back an hour. These are the things that we've come to expect with these sorts of procedures being happening online. But once the trial got started, the first chunk was an agreed statement of facts. It was read out to the courtroom, and really it went through horrifying detail of what happened on April 23rd, 2018, talking about how and where each victim was hit by the van driven by Alec Manassian was, and sort of played out the entire sequence of events leading up to Alec Manassian's arrest after that van attack happened. We then heard, or they played the interrogation video, nearly 4 hours of interrogation of Alec Manassian shortly after the attack. And so really that's what encompassed the first day. We didn't hear any of the legal arguments, but it was laying the groundwork for what we are going to expect over the next several weeks.
Yeah, I spoke to one of the relatives, someone whose grandmother died in that attack. We just showed the pictures of the victims. So devastating. Look, he's pleading not criminally responsible, and it's going to hinge on his mental state, even though he's admitted it all. What do we know about that and what he's saying about that?
Well, he has pleaded not criminally responsible, as you mentioned. That's sort of what we heard from Alec Manassian today. He was joining the court from his jail cell on the Zoom call, and he spoke those words to the judge. But really what it's going to hinge on is his state of mind. We know we're going to hear from forensic psychologists, psychiatrists that will be called by both the defense and the Crown, and they will try to prove that whether he knew what he was doing, whether he knew what he was doing was wrong, or if he was living in an alternate, you know, reality, that he didn't understand the consequences of the actions he took that day. I've spoken to some criminal defense lawyers today, and it is a steep hill, they say, for the defense to climb in this case. You know, they have to prove, of course, beyond a reasonable doubt, that he, you know, or rather, they have to prove that he didn't understand the consequences of his actions that day. But we've seen a lot of evidence that show that he understood, you know, the authority of the police officer who arrested him at the end of that video. So, you know, it's going to be a tough hill to climb, but they've got about 4 weeks that have been laid out for this trial to try to make that case.
Yeah, and he was very open about it when he was arrested. just a horrific situation, and for the families to relive it and for everybody to see that today. Heather, thanks for joining us today on a trial the whole country's watching. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
And we want to hear from you always. Thoughts on our program, thoughts on the pandemic, on whatever you want to talk about, let us know. Maybe stories you think we should be covering. CTV Power Play on Facebook, all these social media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and email. Let us know. We love listening to you, and we do. Coming up, Donald Trump's last stand.
I just think it's an embarrassment, quite frankly.
Joe Biden pushes forward with his transition without any official access from a president who still won't concede. What happens now? We dig into that with CTV's Richard Madd next. Stay with us.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly. The world should have every confidence that the transition necessary to make sure that the State Department is functional today, and successful with a president who's in office on January 20th, a minute afternoon, will also be successful.
Okay, so no concession. That's America's top diplomat, Mike Pompeo, saying there'll be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. So President Trump continues to challenge the election results. He has still not provided any evidence of this widespread voter fraud, he's alleged. President-elect Joe Biden called Donald Trump's refusal to concede the election an embarrassment. But what does it all mean? Is there going to be a transition of power? CTV's Richard Madden joins us from Washington, D.C., fresh off covering the Biden campaign. Secretary Pompeo, he said the world's watching. What does Donald Trump now contend? And after all these days, Richard, has he provided any evidence of fraud that he keeps alleging?
Absolutely no evidence of fraud, but the president and his campaign are moving ahead with lawsuits. And really, at this point, I think it's an optics situation, because you move ahead with a lawsuit, it implies some sort of wrongdoing, but there has been not one single shred of evidence to back up the president's claims. In fact, today in Arizona, the Trump campaign said that there was evidence of voter fraud, and they identified less than 200 ballots that they singled out that might be irregular. That is obviously just nothing. And obviously just a couple hundred ballots is not going to tip the scales to flip a state. So the Trump campaign continues to do this. They're trying to fundraise off it. But at the end of the day, several American news outlets are reporting that the president will eventually concede, possibly as early as Friday. And this is part of the grieving process. But as long as this continues, though, Evan, it's somewhat damaging to the United States standing to the rest of the world. Is this democracy everyone can look at and admire?
Well, look, Donald Trump's Twitter account's really busy on this. Joe Biden actually had a press conference today. What did he say? He was asked about it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, look, Biden has this confidence when he speaks. He's obviously moving ahead, looking at the job of governing this country. He's making a domestic priority, a coronavirus task force. He's already signaled he's going to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, among other things. So Biden was asked that directly, what he thinks of this, and he was right. The president of the United States does not have to concede, but at the end of the day, Joe Biden will get the keys to the Oval Office on January 20th. The Trump administration has not really helped him with the transition. The point person that's in charge of the whole sort of transition side of government has been resisting helping the Biden administration. Biden seemed to be brushing it off. He was saying that, you know, he's going to do this whether or not the president likes it. Likes the situation. And he said it would be nice to get these intelligence briefings. It'd be nice to get this help through the transition, but he's not worried about it. And then he went on to say, with a slight dig at Republicans who continue to back up and support Trump's claims without evidence of some sort of widespread fraud, you know, Biden just said perhaps some Republicans are intimidated by this current president.
Yeah, I think there's only about four, like the senator from Maine, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney. Only four Republicans have really backed him up in this, but we'll find out what happens on Friday or as the days go on. Richard Madden, great to have you on the program as always. Rich, thanks, sir.
Yeah, you bet.
All right, now let me just bring in some other news you need to know right now. A Toronto MP has been booted from the Liberal caucus after admitting to improperly hiring her sister to work at her constituency office. Yasmin Ratansi represents Don Valley East in Toronto. In a Facebook post, she says she made, quote, an error in judgment by employing her sister and hiding it. She says she's remedied the situation, but that does not excuse her error. She has referred this to the ethics commissioner. Ratansi is apologizing to her constituents, says she will continue to represent them as an independent MP, but the Conservatives say no, that's not good enough. They want her to resign her seat. Later in the program, we're going to bring this up with the press gallery. How bad is another ethical breach for the Liberal Party? Should she pay back the money? So we'll talk about that in a minute. Meantime, the federal government announced the creation of a new fund today to help struggling Legions and veterans organizations from the impact of COVID-19. The lion's share of the $20 million, quote, Veterans Organizations Emergency Support Fund will go to the Royal Canadian Legion. They've been asking for a long time to help keep branches open. Since June, at least 21 branches have closed permanently or they're in the process of closing. Well, the allocation of the spending is new. The support itself was introduced in the government's COVID-19 aid package passed in early October. And remember, we will have special coverage of tomorrow's National Remembrance Day ceremony in Ottawa, hosted, of course, by CTV News chief anchor and senior news editor Lisa Laflamme. That begins at 10:30 Eastern, 7:30 Pacific, right here on CTV and on CTV News Channel. That's an important moment. Make sure you mark that. Coming up, more shocking losses at a long-term care home due to COVID-19. Who's accountable? What needs to be done? The CEO of Canada's National Seniors Advocacy Organization, Laura Tamblyn-Watts, joins the press gallery next. We got lots ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back. Tragic loss. Eight people died in a Manitoba care home over the span of 48 hours. Over a dozen 911 calls, 911 calls rather, had been made from the Maples long-term care home. Manitoba's health care minister called for an inquiry into the Maples long-term care home and the Parkview Place long-term care home. Parkview is the home to the province's deadliest COVID-19 outbreak. This is just all too familiar, isn't it? Long-term care homes hit hardest in the first wave. 80% of Canada's COVID-19 deaths tied to long-term care homes. We thought we fixed it. We haven't. Are we doomed to repeat these tragedies in a second wave? Talk about that. And you heard earlier in this program from the mayor of Winnipeg. They want help. What do they need? The press gallery is here. Bob Fife from the Globe and Mail, the Ottawa bureau chief. Emily Nicolas, columnist with Le Devoir. And Laura Tamblyn-Watts is the CEO of CanAge, which, of course, works in this, is the leading advocate for this. And Laura, I'll start with you because, and great to have everyone here, but this was devastating in Manitoba. What does that tell you when you see these outbreaks in a place in more long-term care homes after what we saw in the first wave already?
You know, lessons weren't learned. This is exactly what we saw in Ontario and Quebec. And I can tell you that the outbreaks in Manitoba are not over yet. We haven't had substantive change in the field of long-term care right now, and we're not ready for the second wave. We're extremely worried about what's happening in Manitoba and beyond those borders.
Can you just dig in? What do you mean? What changes need to be made there? What do you think has been the contributing factor?
So we know that staffing is very short-sighted. We know that we don't actually have the amount of money from the federal government to the provinces that we need. And we know that we don't actually have the infection prevention and control in place at this time.
Bob Fife, pick up on this. When you saw this, and we've all been watching this, we were supposed to have these iron rings around long-term care homes before. That didn't happen. Here we go again. What does it tell you, Bob? What stands out to you?
Look, this is a national disgrace. We all know what the problem is. These are privately run senior citizens' homes, and a lot of them, frankly, they are badly run. In Ottawa, for example, nurses have told me that senior citizens, many with dementia, and some of these privately run homes are put in four people per room, very, very small rooms. They have to share the same bathroom. There's no place to The staff only gets 30 hours a week, so they have to work at other places because they don't want to pay them overtime and they don't want to pay them benefits. This is a recipe for the kind of deaths that we're seeing in Manitoba and that we saw in Quebec and Ontario. The federal government has to step in, has to provide the money so the provinces can take over these privately run facilities. They need to be publicly run because the staff can be paid properly. You can put in the proper protocols and you can save lives. Our seniors do not need to be treated like this.
Emily, in Quebec, it was devastating there as well. The military called in there to help out. I thought this was fixed. It's not. What do you make of it?
I don't think anybody thought it would be fixed in the sense that a lot of the changes that are needed are very concrete, long-term overhaul, you know, policy change that cannot happen overnight. What's sad is that there a lot of times they're not even started because people basically follow the provinces and the federal government have been fighting in the last couple of months in terms of who should be responsible for that health reform and right. And the Quebec doesn't want the federal government to get too involved in that and so there's a lot of like arguing over federal competence but there's also the issue that all of those issues that we're seeing now is things that orderlies is saying that nurses have been saying for years and you just alluded to the army. It was interesting how when the boys came in they did this report that said here are the list of issues and then everybody paid attention and fix some of it, while the nurses and the orderlies, who are overwhelmingly women, had been saying the same thing and were not listened to at all. And so there's also this culture of hierarchical culture where if doctors say something, people listen to it, but the needs that are underground are needs that, you know, the people that know better yeah. what the solutions are people whose word are undervalued, and we don't actually pay attention to them in terms of sources for policy solutions.
Yeah, they're not listened to, they're underpaid, and then all of a sudden everyone calls them heroes on the front lines, and then they forget right. about them.
Yes,
Laura, let me
and
just
even
go back.
Them
Bob
sometimes.
Said Bob said they've got to Bob said they've got to, you know, maybe shift away from privately run to publicly run. Is that the best solution, or should there be what some have said, national standards that are enforceable? Where if you want to be privately run, as Bob said, you got to give people full hours. They can't work in multiple places. They got to be paid a bare minimum, like a wage that's higher than the minimum wage. What do you think needs to happen?
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult to actually nationalize long-term care. So it's aspirational that we might want to have everything in nonprofit, but it's not actually feasible. About 50% of all care across this country is provided by for-profit homes, and some of them are smaller and some of them are the big chains. What we've seen in Australia, which is a very similar model in terms of division of powers, is they have a national regulator, national quality standards, and real teeth. Mm. So per incident, they can actually charge up to $100,000 per incident. And so national quality care standards are the way to go. And CanAge, amongst other organizations, have been calling for that. Happy to see that the throne speech said that. But what we want is to make sure that the federal government supports right. the provinces' care homes now, not wait any longer.
Bob, does I can't believe people are dying in the thousands and we're talking about jurisdictional issues. That's the reality. Does a jurisdictional issue prevent putting teeth in those national standards?
Well, I mean, the problem we have is that, you know, the healthcare is a provincial responsibility, but the federal government pays a lot of money and they have a lot of clout if they want to step in. And to the point of view of getting a national regulator, he should definitely try for that. But the problem we're going to have is that just like we tried to get a national security regulator, you're going to run into problems with the provinces. They're going to say we shouldn't do this. But the federal government does have a lot of power. It has the money and it should step in. It's got to do something because people are dying and the provinces aren't willing to act.
Yeah, Emily, would Quebec accept a national regulator?
I mean, even if it was national in the sense of Quebec regulator, you know, to try to have similar conditions, whether or not you're in the private or public system within a given province, that would already be a start, right? I don't think that the federal standards would necessarily be different than the one that the provinces would set for themselves. Yeah. But beyond that, I think it's we I It's the issue of saying that the private system is not is inevitable. When you look at how it was mostly built in the 90s. It's not always been like that. And so there's way for us to reverse that if we end up, you know, with results that what matters is profits and not human rights. We can reverse that. There was policy that engineered it, and those policies are not part of the DNA of Canada. They're actually not that old at all.
Hear, hear.
All right. That's a great point. Guys, let me take a break. Laura Tamblyn-Watt, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program with your insight into an issue. Again, folks, we're focusing on this issue because people are dying. Canadians are dying. It is urgent. Coming up, though, the economy and an ethics issue. First, Joe Biden's presidency. What does it mean for the energy sector? The former Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall is going to join us. And then another ethics violations for a Liberal. This time a Liberal MP has just been given the boot from caucus. She hired her own sister. Should she pay back the money? Should she even give up her seat? We find out all that next, and Brad Wall is going to join us. Stay with us. Welcome back. All right, we got an economic story and an ethics story. First, many were quick to dub a Biden win a win for Canada. Those in the energy sector said, not so fast. The president-elect has vowed to kill the Keystone XL pipeline that's supposed to deliver 800,000 barrels a day of Alberta crude oil to the U.S. Gulf Coast refineries. So how will Ottawa, and remember, Trudeau has always supported this pipeline, will he be able to convince Biden not to pull the permit on that, the presidential permit? And meantime, a Liberal MP was kicked out of caucus after she admitted she hired her sister against the rules. We did request her, Yasmin Ratansi, to join us on this program to explain what happened. We never heard back from her, but the press gallery is here to discuss all that. Bob Fyfe is the Ottawa bureau chief at the Globe and Mail. He was just here. So is Emily Nicolas. She's back from Le Devoir. And our special guest is the former Saskatchewan Premier, Brad Wall, now a special advisor to Osler, Hoskin and Harcourt. But probably more importantly, he's Coulter Wall's dad, and you got to get used to that. Coulter's a great musician. Brad, let me just start with you. Good to see you. Trudeau and Biden spoke about this. They raised Keystone. There are powerful forces in a Biden potential administration that want to kill Keystone. What can, what should Trudeau do?
Well, credit to the federal government to be raising the issue on these early calls. I've heard ministers in the federal government also make the case that this will be important for Canada as they engage with the new administration. I would say that there's a period of opportunity now in the, you know, so-called lame duck portion between Election Day and Inauguration Day, which is until the third week of January, for progress to be made. But also, Evan, I would point this out, that the energy policy of the United States, the environmental policy of the United States, as it intersects with our energy sector, goes beyond the pipeline, goes beyond KXL. And here's what I mean by that. If Biden is true to his commitment in the second televised debate, where he kind of used pretty strong language about phasing out of fossil fuels, if he's true to that, his administration might, through the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, or the DOE, the Department of Energy, sort of move against America's oil and gas sector. And that could take many manifestations. It could limit or ban some areas in terms of fracking or development on federal lands. Right. And perhaps then we could see a freeing up of investment, some of it Canadian, that's gone to the Permian play in Texas and Oklahoma, freed up or directed back to Canada. So maybe that actually could put his policies that would possibly be negative for the oil and gas sector in his country could potentially be beneficial, salutary for our sector here in Canada.
Yeah, Bob, weigh in on that. He did talk about ending fracking, but over time, he will rejoin the Paris Climate Accord that aligns with Justin Trudeau. But I keep saying this, a pipeline runs through that relationship as it did with Obama and Harper. What do you make of how Justin Trudeau's got to respond to this?
Well, Mr. Trudeau and his foreign affairs minister, as you on your show on Sunday, they're making the point that they are going to try to convince Biden not to kill Keystone, but I just don't think that's going to work. Mr. Biden has got to satisfy the environmentalists in the left wing of his party who are determined that Keystone be killed. And there is nothing in it for him to upset that group as he heads into the as he begins his term in office by keeping Keystone alive. So unfortunately for Alberta and Saskatchewan, I think he's going to go ahead and kill Keystone. The issue, though, is that a large part of that pipeline has already been built. I'm not exactly sure how far it has been built, but I'd be interested to know from Brad how far, if he kills it, how much of the pipeline has already been built, and what would the effect of that be?
Well, yeah, it's already crossed the border, Emily. Let me just bring in Emily, and I'll just flip back to you on that, Brad. Emily, I know Quebecers have not supported pipelines running west-east, but what do you make of the Biden-Trudeau relationship that has a warm side, but on this particular issue, a very cold side as well?
Well, I was reading the quotes from François-Philippe Champagne this weekend, who was talking about how it's important for Americans to prefer Canadian oil because of Canadian environmental values and human rights, as opposed to oil that would come from Russia or Venezuela or these other countries. But I think this kind of discourse actually can hurt both Trudeau and Biden, in the sense that if we're talking about human rights, we're talking about Indigenous rights. And this is the same, the Keystone Pipeline would go through the same region that led to the Standing Rock, actually, resistance in the right. South Dakota a couple of years ago. So you would end into, lead into an Indigenous movement that does not make the Trudeau government looks good on reconciliation, nor does it make the Biden government looks good in terms of its own environmental activism and its own, trying to appease right. the social tensions in the U.S. So I don't think for either prime minister or premier or president, it's actually a good and silly move, unfortunately, for Alberta.
Well, I will say Trudeau's all in on this, though, Brad. Well, just can you just pick up on what Bob said? Like, where are we at with this pipeline?
Well, I don't know how far south it is already. Certainly, it's made a lot of progress. And I think we've also seen the Alberta government invest in the project directly and provide some guarantees. So there is a lot at stake. And I think it needs to be a top priority for the prime minister. It looks to be, and I'm glad that's the case in terms of his engagement. But I don't think we can understate the importance of sort of an analysis on what Biden administration policies might mean in the United States and their impact then in Canada. And that's what I referenced off the top. Let's remember that under Trump policies, or his administration policies certainly, and under the then price structure, we saw America become energy independent. That could change if they decide to withdraw, if they decide to shut down production or limit it in some way through policy. And if that's the case, then they're our number one export market. And that could put the Canadian sector in a slightly better position.
Yeah, for sure. There might be opportunities there. Bob, let me shift over to the Liberal member of parliament, now the independent, Yasmeen Vertanzi. We invited her on the show, no response. This, and credit to CBC, who first reported this and broke this story, Ashley Burke. She employed her sister at a constituency office using public funds. The Conservatives want to boot her out, have a by-election there. How damaging is another ethical scandal for the Liberals?
Well, I'm not sure that this is going to damage the government that bad, because they move very quickly. But it certainly is damaging her credibility and, I suppose, a bit of the Liberal brand. I mean, she went out of her way to cover up the fact that her sister was being paid by taxpayers' dollars. My view is that it's not going to lead to a resignation, but I definitely think she should be repaying the money back to Canadian taxpayers. She went out of her way to, in essence, to pull the blanket over Canadian taxpayers' faces. In a way, it was almost a way of defrauding the taxpayers, and I do think that she should repay that money back. And as for whether she should resign or not, let the voters decide next time around, which will probably be in the spring in any case, Evan.
Yeah, I should tell people, Emily, when she first hired her sister, the rules actually didn't prohibit you from hiring a sibling, but then they did in 2017, and then she went ahead and hired her anyway. What do you make of the impact of this?
Well, the impact is mostly political. It's because the Liberals are caught into this narrative of ethical scandal because of the Wii scandal. If it wasn't for the Wii scandal, I don't even know that we would make much of this story, because it's, you know, a writing, office with an MP that's not a minister. So I'm not saying there should not be consequences for it. I'm just saying that the Conflict of Interest Act and all of the policies that are in place are in place to manage those kinds of cases. So we shouldn't necessarily have a by-election every time those things happen, but there needs definitely to be some accountability mechanism for those mistakes.
I got a minute for you, Brad Wall. What does this tell you?
Well, it goes to pattern. I agree. I mean, this would not be as significant were it not in such close proximity to the Wii scandal, which was about family members indirectly and directly benefiting from public money. It was about a massive sole source contract. And I don't think that particular issue is really over yet. I think there's some legs there in terms of the Canadian public. And so this is sort of a small chapter of the same book, I think, and that's a problem, I think, for the Liberals, although they did act quickly and needed to, I think, in this case.
Yeah, well, they're getting good at this because it keeps happening, and they're certainly keeping the Ethics Commissioner busy. The Ethics Commissioner is juggling so many files right now, it's quite something. All right, I got to leave it there, guys, but man, I had no rest for the Ethics Commissioner right now. Brad Wall, Emily and Bob, great to have
no
all,
rest for
all
anyone
three of you
in
on the program, as always. No, there's no... Emily, you're exactly
someone,
right.
Someone should,
sleep is for next year.
Someone should investigate how I got to be a member of the press gallery. That would be investigated.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, you keep rocking that mustache, we'll invite you back. All right, that's your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for watching, everyone. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Lots to come. We always love hearing from you. Remember, if it's safe, hug your loved ones, be kind to each other, have a great evening, and we'll be back tomorrow.